Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to The Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. The Reason Podcast is where I speak with Reason's top thinkers and luminaries and also Catherine Mengu Ward. And today,
hey.
Hello, today we're going to discuss single-payer healthcare, America's ongoing war with anybody that looked at us funny, and the push-pull of Harvard bringing people to speak at the campus. So first, Bernie Sanders, Medicare for All. Last week, Senator Sanders introduced his single-payer Medicare for All bill, which would extend Medicare to everyone in America, thus effecting a single-payer system here. 15 Democrats have signed on to it, which is more than it was 2 years ago. So that seems to be entering the national consciousness. So I'm going to pitch it to you, Catherine. Single-payer health care, good idea, bad idea?
We're starting there, huh? We're going all in. Well, as we know, Matt loves socialized medicine, so he can probably stick up for it later. But I feel like we're now living in the Christopher Buckley world of politics, where the thing that crazy right-wingers threatened would happen, like the slippery slope that people threatened would happen 4 years ago, is now reliably the reality. So it's like, oh, if we let this Obamacare thing happen, the Democrats will never be satisfied. They're just going to up the stakes to single payer. And lo and behold, here we are in the worst case scenario, probably, in which somehow single payer seems more normal, more appropriate, a better system for America than it did before we did a really, really bad job of taking a few steps in that direction.
You know, it's also great that Sanders, learned a lesson, because he's not calling it single payer. He's calling it Medicare for All. Medicare.
Who doesn't like Medicare?
Yeah, no. Yeah. And, I've been looking through Hillary Clinton's book, and in the late 90s or early 2000s, she talked about why Social Security and Medicare were good programs. And it wasn't based on they took care of people who were too poor. She bluntly addressed her baby boomer cohort and said, we don't want to have to bring our parents to live with us. And this gives us a way of getting
around it.
That's
a better bumper sticker. It's
actually kind of true. And it blurs all the fact that, like, the reason why old people can't afford their insurance is because it's given to them basically for free or heavily subsidized. This is a terrible idea because, as it exists, Medicare is the single largest driver of deficit spending in the country. The taxes that go to pay for Medicare, taxes and other government transfers, pay for less than they pay for about 50%, 40 to 50%, depending on the program and the year. So what you're talking about, Medicare, old people love Medicare because there's effectively no cap on the amount of treatments you can get, and you either pay nothing or next to nothing for it, including prescription drugs, including going to the doctor and things like that. If you ramp that up to a nationwide program, all you are doing is, doubling, quintupling, betting, cubing, just exploding the amount of money that the government would be paying for healthcare.
Which is kind of what happens whenever a state tries it, right?
Like Vermont, which is Sanders' own place, they were like, fuck, we can't do it. It'll kill us. And what were the numbers on, like, New York and California, both of
California? California is twice the budget, I think, for California.
At least twice. I think between two and three times the budget was the estimate.
So it's like what they spend every year in all aspects of the government, they would have to double that just for healthcare to cover single payer,
which then whisks you immediately into the rationing zone, mm-hmm. which is where things start to get real and unpleasant,
and where Medicare avoids that because it's only serving people 65 and older.
Right. Yeah. I mean, at some point they just die.
Yeah,
I guess.
Pretty much.
But I mean, this is right. Like, old people go to the doctor just kind of like because it's Tuesday, because they don't bear any cost for it. And this is the place where the kind of economically literate critique sounds like a dickish thing to say, like, oh, you don't want old people to go to the doctor if they feel bad? And it's like, sometimes no. Sometimes you should not go to the doctor just because you're retired and, like, your elbow hurts.
Well, so what about, there are lots of neighboring countries that have single-payer health care, which seem to be doing okay.
No, there is one.
There's, if we're going with no C rates and that kind of thing, yeah.
Well, if we're talking about Canada, though, Canada is a unique system, which also, when you were talking about, Catherine, about how people were worried that Obamacare was the first step, not the final act. It was the first step toward single payer, not the last act of the Great Society. Canada started socializing its medical system in the early 60s. It only completed that in the mid-80s to the system that we know now. But in Canada, you can't even go outside the system like you can in England and most other countries that have government-funded health care. So it's a very bizarre system, and, there are well-documented problems with that. And it's starting to break down, and they're having to allow private, and you know, private practitioners.
And they can cross the border south.
And I'd add to that.
You're welcome for having an expensive, screwed up, but sort of private system down here in the U.S. of A.
Canada also, I think, it sort of mirrors Europe in terms of a critique I have for single-payer proponents in that there's not so much a national Canadian healthcare program as there are provincial healthcare programs. They're funded and run by the individual provinces, and the federal government of Canada deals with negotiating pharmaceutical prices and First Nations people. So it would be like if every U.S. state had its own individual single-payer healthcare program. Comparably, there is no European healthcare program at all. There's a bunch of
having said that, we
programs.
Do have that effect somewhat with Medicaid because there are 50 different versions of it, and it's the funding is split between the government and the states. But the one thing about Medicaid is that all of them suck, pretty much.
Yeah, no one wants to be
so,
on it.
There's always whenever there's a moment of intense discussion about healthcare policy, like there will be for an hour and a half today, as we're still pretending that the Graham Cassidy bill has any chance in hell, which I don't think that it has, largely because I don't have enough mental time to pretend that it does and to kind of deal with it.
You're above all that.
In those moments, Democrats, liberals, and progressives will say, well, if you don't like X, you're in favor of more people dying. This also happened during the passage of Obamacare, famously with Ezra Klein, I think over at Fox, maybe Washington Post back then, just kind of like, you know, Republicans or opponents of this just want more poor people to die. And that's what's going to happen. And the thing is, there are studies out there. I mean, there's a famous Oregon study, a huge kind of blind study of people who got Medicaid because of the lottery and people in the exact same situation who did not get Medicaid because of the lottery. And it's a fascinating study because there are no appreciable differences in health care outcomes between the two, which goes against all basic ideas that people bandy about when they talk about this. There is one appreciable difference, and I think it's an important one and one that should be grappled with as we discuss this, kind of in a similar sense that school choice, people always feel a lot better, even if the results aren't necessarily always better. People feel better. They feel like they have more of a sense of security that got the Medicaid as opposed to the ones who didn't. So they're worrying about it less.
And they do have lower rates of bankruptcy or financial hardship.
Right.
Is not a small thing.
Which is not a small thing. But in terms of pure health care outcomes, there is no appreciable difference.
The experiment, when you say there was a lottery, did they have a limited amount of Medicaid positions, or was it they were trying to extend?
Yeah,
Medicaid?
They were trying a new system, and so there were these. You know, it's kind of a natural experiment because there were a number of slots open and more applicants for that, so they chose them by lottery. So you assume the two groups are comparable in health status and things like that.
And the thing is, like, our language, like the way we talk about this, we always, always elide the distinction between having health insurance and having good health care and having good health outcomes. And this is the more you want single payer, the more you want government to run health care, the more likely your language is to reflect the fact that you want people to think and believe, and you yourself probably think and believe, that having health insurance is the same thing as being healthier, and it's not.
Questions about Medicare, you know, for old people, like has Medicare, the question isn't like are older people living longer now than they were in 1966 or around 1970 when it was fully implemented, but have the gains been greater than they would have been otherwise or compared to other countries? And it's not clear that Medicare is, you know, it costs a lot, but it's not clear, like you're saying, that it's much better for outcome.
There's also this tricky problem, right, of like, well, I'm comparing the health outcomes under Medicare to the magical free market healthcare system that literally no one has ever seen. And even Peter Suderman has to take like just a lot of shrooms before he can like approximate in his mind, and then he can't.
Which would be cheaper probably under Medicare.
Right. Well, and in fact, if you believe Reason reporter Mike Riggs, we should probably all be microdosing certain psychedelics to improve our health outcomes.
Wait,
and probably
reduce
health expenditures.
We're not all doing that?
I can only speak for Mike Riggs when I say we are.
So the Catherine healthcare plan is the free market plus
plus shrooms.
Plus
yeah,
shrooms.
That's
okay.
It.
Well, can I go back to the whole single payer thing? There seem to be countries where people are at least pleased with it, even if the outcome's not good. Can single payer work?
In this country, no, it cannot, because it requires a level of coercion and force that ends up becoming not either unconstitutional or just kind of against our ability to do things. So France is one case where a country that I have some experience with their healthcare system, I won't be able to adequately describe it. France and Switzerland both have different versions of a universal healthcare, but unlike the British NHS, you have a lot more private choice within it, and you can do a lot more business just at the local pharmacy. They have the ability to prescribe stuff to you and say, "Hey, look, I think it's this. Do this. Here's the cream. Here's the money. Go," kind of thing. Switzerland, it's more you have to. It's like a driver's license. You have to show proof of insurance. And then it's almost all supplied through the private sector. It can be really expensive. It's also really super good. But we don't have that ability to coerce people, according to the Supreme Court, into buying health insurance. But France has a very productive public sector. It's the most productive public sector in the world. There's a belief in it's withering, but a belief in the state in France, which it doesn't.
We don't really have over here.
We don't have a productive public sector. Any place where there's a lot of spending or there's guaranteed revenues or the U.S. government system is by definition an area of corruption and inefficiency. And also Americans just intrinsically don't really have that sense. If you want to see what single payer healthcare looks like in this country, look at the fucking VA system. That's what it looks like in this country. It's a fucking disaster.
The question of does single payer work is like, yeah, it works. It works. The American healthcare system as it is right now also works. But it works in the same way that, like, I don't know, people in the Middle Ages had food. But, it does, like, the possibilities are so utterly unrealized, right? Like, it works barely. It works only because we don't know what really working would even look like. And, I think to say, like, oh, look over there, like, people aren't just, like, dropping dead in the street of influenza in France, so, like, probably single payer is fine for us here. I think that's like a weird argument because it's so bounded by garbage systems across the world when we could be trying for something better.
And I think we see, glimpses of what a market-based healthcare system would look like when you look at things like eye care. I'm looking across the table at Matt, who has glasses on. I have contacts, and I'm not sure, but you
laser
guys.
Laser
20/20 vision.
Laser.
I am a god.
No, but where there are where insurance coverage is less, you see the type of innovation and the drop in prices. You got LASIK or something,
man,
like that?
Yeah, man. And I got my laser eyeballs in like 2002.
So
when
you
cost,
paid enormous amounts
of
money.
I literally
for that.
Sold a kidney, and now it would just be like, I could just walk in and like kind of scrape the spare change out of my pockets, and they'd be like, 2020 it is.
Well, and this is, I think a larger question here, because even in places like France, and one of the things they do in France is that you pay up front and get reimbursed for most things. So it acts as a check. So you don't just go and run up insurance bills all the time because you are, there's kind of checks and balances. In most single payer systems, with the exception of Medicare, there is some kind of limit in Canada. They just ration care. They say we're not paying for that, so there are longer wait times for regular procedures that I don't think Americans would put up for. But everywhere around the globe, the public sector is shrinking because every aging population in the OECD countries and the industrialized nations realize they have to trim public spending. It's just unsupportable because it was based on a world where you had many more children than you had old people. And that's no longer the case. And it's time for us to, really to kind of level, to clear the field of the stumps, the dried up, old, withered, rotting stumps of the 20th century.
You're referring to Bernie Sanders there, right?
You're referring to the actual people. Old people we're going to let die.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. But seriously, what we need to be doing is figuring out, you don't have to rip the system up, root and branch and things like that. But we have to be moving more towards a system where the market is allowed to play, because the market and market isn't magic, but it is. It creates innovation.
It's a good cost-saving mechanism.
It reduces prices.
Friendship is magic. Just to be clear.
Yeah, no, that's true. And unicorns and rainbows, of course, and cotton candy. But we need to be moving towards that, because there's no way, every developed economy is moving towards Japan, where there are just a ton of old people and not enough young people to support them through taxes or through physical labor. Let the market work, and and that's where we should be going towards, beyond health savings accounts or medical savings accounts, and just let people deregulate the supply in medicine, which nobody ever fucking talks about. Like, in all of the Obamacare stuff, nobody just said, like, why don't we double the number of doctors that we certify every
year. Which is held back by what? The American Medical Association?
Yeah, everybody who's in the status
quo
now.
With the cheerful cooperation of the state.
Yeah, and the
we're,
nurses.
We're not letting nurses dispense things that they could do, or letting pharmacies prescribe cream and say go.
Matt, you did your own rotator cuff surgery,
sure,
right?
Sure, yeah. I just got a little some fishing line and a lure in there and just kind of yanked on it. There's an interesting kind of political thing that's happening now, too. That there's magical realism that's baked into this. We had a piece about at Reason.com about how Bernie Sanders was kind of against universal Medicare for all.
He used to believe in math at one point.
Hillary Clinton famously dinged Sanders during the campaign for having his health care thing just costing the trillions of dollars and it was unworkable. It became this big, big fight on the left. And it's kind of clear that where the left has taken this, where the Democratic Party has taken this, is like, screw it. We're not going to pretend that math is a constraint anymore. So they've gone into this kind of magical realism in terms of the cost. And that's interesting for a lot of reasons, one of which is that when Obamacare was passed, they were still anchored in the political realism of not wanting to confront one thing which every single person that I've ever seen has identified as kind of the original sin of the American healthcare system, whether you're libertarian, conservative, progressive, whatever. It's that we tied healthcare to employment during or after World War II because there was a wage freeze. And so because you needed to break that. If you wanted to do real reform and allow prices to work their magic and having some people, having some sense of individual choice into the system, that's what you would do. But they didn't do it then because they were afraid that people would freak out. They were constrained by a sense of political realism then, and so they didn't do the one thing that they really needed to do and could have started any number of different kinds of reform, including, a reform saying, hey, let's make most of it private and let's have a safety net for those who can't deal with it. I mean, there are different options that were left off the table.
Sounds okay to me, what you just described.
So then the question is, what happens now when we've given up, we've untethered that realism? I think, to Nick's point, that maybe there should be some interesting, magical realism or at least thought experiments done on the opposite side of the magical realism of Bernieomics and start thinking in terms of clean slates and somewhere else, because the incremental approach has led to this patchwork kind of awfulness that we have here. And it's just not a good system. I mean, I'm wearing a dumb fake sling here for sympathy or so that people don't knock into me on the subway.
Get first line of the airport, yeah.
Your bottle of Boone's Farm in there. That's a fake arm when you're sucking
I can't.
On your
that's
thumb.
The Chris Elliott arm in Scary Movie 2. Just licking the turkey. I can't tell you how many stupid time wasting conversations, paperworks, and all this kind of stuff that I've had, and confusing billing back and forth already. And I'm just like 6 days out of this. So I'm going to be dealing with the financial.
You should just cut it off. Yeah.
The paperwork ramifications of this thing for the next 5 months without any question at all. It's stupid. It's completely inefficient.
I also think the paperwork and the incredible extra special stupidity of the way that paperwork works in our healthcare system is such a clear. It's such a clear kind of metric for how far the healthcare system is from real market forces. Like when I want to buy something online now, and of course I can buy literally anything online, my browser autofills everything about me. Like I just like kind of think hard about wanting to buy a dress and it's like done. And when you go into the doctor's office, you write your address.
Like every time.
60, 70 times.
I have to tell them I'm not pregnant.
And you're writing it down for then somebody who is going to type it in.
Or maybe just throw it away because you're going to write it again next time.
I've written down right shoulder, that phrase, 25 times.
Right. So like just the idea that mechanism, which is so totally unmoored from these like incredibly great convenience-enhancing advances of like just something with like a little smidge of the profit motive in there, just like a little bit.
If I can, one of the things that's interesting, a couple of weeks ago I was in New York and I had a medical, emergency or situation put up. I went to an urgent care.
Pointing like this way. Make me uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's right.
Go on.
I am pointing there, Matt. Do you want to describe it? No, but I went to an urgent care place and it was in my healthcare network and whatnot. And I found that on the healthcare company's app. You go in, and it's kind of cash for service. I mean, it's a much more in-and-out type of thing. And what I was thinking about when you were talking about filling stuff out, there were no forms to fill. They took the information and typed it directly in. And it was like I was in and out in like 30 minutes with a prescription. And, that's like another – that's kind of like a magical or a non-magical realism of like, it was open at like 9 o'clock at night. which is unheard of for most places, and I didn't have to go to the emergency room. Those places are popping up because there are incentives, ironically, under Obamacare, because there's so many high deductible programs. Like, you know, like I'm on the hook for like, I don't know, like the first $3,000 or $4,000 of medical care on everything every year. And there's people who want to cash in on that. And I also, you know, I'm willing to spend it. So there are ways that market forces can, you know, just create better, you know, more accessible health.
Well, that's how you know it's so bad. When people can compete with the incredibly deeply subsidized system and still make money, right? I mean, this is how you know that public schools are incredibly bad, because private schools exist and people pay $50,000 a year for them. Like, this is how you know that the healthcare system is total garbage, because I, for instance, pay like $200 a year or something for one medical, which is, you know,
oh, yeah,
you get an appointment, you have an app, you don't wait in line, you don't fill out your freaking address 50,000 times.
I can text them when I need a prescription.
Right.
It's great.
But then, you know, you got to get a new rotator cuff or whatever happened to Matt. And you know, at that level of the system, it is still too hard to compete with free. And that's why
that's
we don't have that option.
I was reading something, and it made me nostalgic for the 80s, but somebody was talking about major medical insurance. Like, when I was working until I was 25 or 26, and then I went to grad school. And when I joined there, like, as a graduate student, you had to pick some kind of health care. That was a requirement of enrolling. But there was a program that was like $300 for major medical program, which meant, you know, I was 25, and like if I got run over by a car, this would cover that, but it wouldn't cover a bunch of other stuff. And then it went all the way up to an old style HMO that was $2,000 a year, and it covered everything. And it's like that whole major medical plan.
Well, that's illegal now.
Yeah, it got wiped out by Obamacare.
And actually, I was talking to my mom and to some of my mom's friends recently about this, and they believe that catastrophic coverage still exists. And I think that's interesting, right? Like, because it's such an obviously intuitive product to exist, like, of course you should be able to insure against the absolute worst for a relatively low rate. That's how insurance works in all the other sectors of our economy.
Dog insurance works that way. It's functional
dog
market.
Insurance?
There's dog healthcare insurance.
Do they replace your dog if you kill it?
They replace your dog if you shoot.
Well, but it's with an equivalent.
Okay.
Or it's two-thirds
the Blue Book
of the
value
dog.
Of your dog?
Yeah, that's right.
Right, but like the fact that we are now like that Obamacare contained within it things that are so damaging to the kind of common sense way that a market should have unfolded and did unfold, and that people are now their like mental model of what the health insurance market even looks like is totally wrong. You know, it's again, it just makes me think
that
like,
I should be able to go there anytime I want and it should be free.
But also that there should be a variant that's not Cadillac, when in fact we all have mandatory Cadillac insurance.
Well, I also love the idea of like, who fucking called it a Cadillac plan? Because it's like
it's
the Cadillac.
It's,
oh, the
no,
Cadillac.
It's,
yeah, no,
it's
the word
so
we all
perfect.
Use.
Because it's like a shitty backwards idea of luxury
like
that's actually
like
inconvenient.
LBJ's
hey, man,
idea
Pete
of a
Welch
nice
drives
car.
A Cadillac, so let's have some
okay,
respect.
Have some respect.
Let's not.
I am going to pause the hating on Obamacare and single payer because I do want to get
well.
To,
Pete Welch was mentioned, Matt's dad,
and I just want that's our code word is to move on whenever Pete Welch is brought up. That means move along. So I will turn to Matt here in a moment because you interviewed Rand Paul last week, did you not?
I sure did. Yes.
Okay. So last Wednesday, Rand Paul got an amendment on the floor of the Senate for a authorization of use of military force or AUMF. Which would have curtailed the six or seven countries we're in. I mean, as I understand it, there was originally a 2001 authorization that was we can fight people that have attacked us via the September 11th attack, and that's sort of been extended beyond and beyond to, well, he's cousins with a guy that sort of was involved in the September 11th attack, and that guy looked at us funny, so we can attack him. So we have this sort of rolling warfare going on. But he got it in, and it got voted down 62-36. So Matt, is it very likely we'll ever get anything like that again? And what would happen if we did?
Very likely is pretty strong language, especially since I think only three Republicans joined. So there's no feeling.
And Jeff Flake wasn't one of them, which surprised me because I sort of thought Jeff Flake would be a non-interventionist type when it came to this.
He's not always scrutable in his voting patterns, to be honest about some things.
Yeah, he pushed back on some of the Patriot Act renewal stuff, but not authorization of military force. He's pretty hawkish.
So a lot like fiscal conservatism, sort of constitutional separation of powers objection to the executive branch's war-making ability is something that the majority of Republicans only really start thinking about when there's a Democratic president doing a war that they don't particularly like.
Obama
this
going into Libya, that was a big deal. They were thinking about impeaching him when that happened.
And I mean, I don't know how much they were thinking about impeaching him, but they were sending some very strongly worded
letters. When they were drunk, they were thinking about it.
Back then, they were thinking about it.
And Obama was very brazen back then, saying that he doesn't need, because they would come up to him and say, "Hey, look, you know, you've already started this. It's been more than 90 days. You're supposed to come after at least and say hi to Congress after 90 days of starting something." He's like, it's not really like a war. It's more like kinetic military activities. So it's just like thumbing his nose at the kind of constitutional order of it. Republicans were very excited about that and angry about that then, and now they are not, because there's a Republican president and it's not that big of a deal. However, it is the first time that we've seen this actually debated or at least voted on the Senate floor, as ridiculous as that is. 15 years on. So, yeah, it's the September 14th, 2001 resolution, which Eli Lake, of all people, wrote a pretty interesting piece for Reason about back in 2010, talking about the 9/14 presidency, all the different ways in which kind of the permanent war on terror is justified because of this. And then it's also the resolution authorization that came in 2012. And so Rand Paul's just making the argument of you need to be specific about this so that Congress can make its war-making thing. Eli, who I talked to also, excuse me, I'm whacking microphones around here, is one of the few people who's, you know, more interventionist than the four people in this room, but will argue that you need to have specific authorizations and they should be sunsetted, or else we're just going to have this kind of permanent drag out.
It's also part of the separation of powers and having constitutional authority to do it. Like there's something to be said for the procedural mechanisms in place of declaring war.
There's all of that. And Rand Paul also comes up with has an argument that I think that hawks in general just always dismiss, which is that you do this. There's a hawk reason to do this. You do this because you need to check in with the political legitimacy of your actions.
And frankly, Americans kind of like war. Like, it's not clear exactly why hawks are so scared to do this. Like, actually having an every 2, 4, or 6 year vote on how we should keep doing the war is probably something that people would take home to their districts and brag about, right? Like,
John Kerry voted for it. Everybody except
the day that it's not
senator.
Is the day that we really need to be not still fighting those wars, right? Right? I mean, this is, you know, Paul said on the floor, I don't think that anyone with an ounce of intellectual honesty believes that these authorizations from 16 years ago and 14 years ago authorized war in 7 different countries.
Seems to be the new norm. Is that where we're headed?
Everyone on the Hill, except for these like 10
dudes.
You
know, it's when the kids started wearing their baseball caps backwards and women started wearing slacks.
Yeah.
It was saggy pants.
It was that crisscross group. You remember that rap group where the kids
wore... My son is bringing that back, by the way. He strongly prefers to wear his shoes on the wrong feet and his pants backwards.
Oh, my God.
He's a tiny,
libertarian
in the making.
I'm
proud of him.
So do you guys know, I was looking at the Senate's website, and according to that, we've declared war 11 times in our history. We've only had 11 declarations of war, and the last one was World War II. We declared war on Romania, spelled with a U. We've been to more countries since then.
Then why do we spell it now with an O? Like it's like
we won the war.
Who won the war?
No, we renamed it Romania, and that was part of the terms of agreement.
I feel like it's giving in.
Yeah. What I want to know, and I don't know if there's an answer to this. I don't know it. How come we did not officially declare war on Vietnam or officially declare war on Korea? Why did we evade that declaration of war?
Yeah, that's a good question. As somebody who just I watched 18 hours of Ken Burns' PBS series on the Vietnam War, which I highly recommended. It debuted last night.
Did you watch all of it last night?
No, I didn't watch it. Because I was watching the first 5 seasons of 24 in a week. So, you know, watched this before.
Yeah, I mean, that's
I feel like I'll need coffee and Ritalin to get through 18 hours of anything in one stretch.
No, and then suddenly you realize why Vietnam soldiers use so much heroin. It kind of makes sense. And also people who are Kiefer Sutherland fans.
The reason they didn't declare war, though, is because it's hard for Congress to do anything big. I mean, if there's anything 2017 has shown us, it's that Congress is freaking terrible at actually saying what they're going to do and then doing it. And war is a big thing.
Can you imagine the bowel movement that Mitch McConnell would have if he actually had to
however
say,
the sentence ends,
we're actually declaring war. Like, saying what we are going to be doing or what we are already doing. But in
if
Korea,
the Mitch McConnells
part of
the
it was
world are scared to say it, then yeah, we shouldn't be doing it.
I agree, but part of it in Korea was that, you know, it really started only a few years after the end of World War II, and we were already still, you know, we were still occupying most of Europe, Japan, a good chunk of the Philippines and whatnot. And it was a United Nations. There was a United Nations resolution, and that's why it was a UN force. And I think part of it was also that Truman was worried, and Democrats in Congress were worried about signing on to a war that was going to be prosecuted by the United Nations because there was fear of one world government and all of that kind of crap. And you didn't have to. But that's the biggest problem here, and I think that's particularly true now. Like, Congress, with the exception of Rand Paul and a couple of other people in the House, nobody gives a shit. You know, they're happy because it's the perfect situation for Congress. If the war goes poorly, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, you know, the president shouldn't have done that. And then if it goes well, they can say like, oh, yeah, I was in favor of it. You know, and so it's just a total elision of responsibility.
One of the basic points of Congress is to never have any on the record votes. That's why so much gets done by voice vote. It's one reason why Justin Amash spends his life trying to block voice votes from happening, right? Because you just get a unanimous, oh, the A's.
Do they not record that?
No. You have to get a roll call vote to actually record it.
You just hear kind of the hollering.
See, on a side note, when you see like a senator votes with the president X amount of times, they're calculating all of the procedural votes. So if you're just saying, yes, we can vote on this particular thing, you voted with the president. So.
No, they can only use tallied votes for those.
Right. But that, as a side note, is widely used in a pretty garbage way by 538 these days, which is something I don't say very often because Nate Silver usually has some pretty strong integrity. But they're saying, oh, you know, such and such senator, Republican senators voted with Donald Trump 94% of the time. Right. It's like confirmations
are
a little bit
bathroom
different
break. Not weighted in terms of the actual issues.
You should weight that stuff. But so Congress just does not want to have their name on record. And one of the things that Rand Paul always does and irritates the hell out of people is that he's constantly trying to get on the record votes on military aid, for example, because military aid is one of those issues where it's hysterically unpopular whenever you poll it. Like, Americans don't want to give money to Egypt. They just don't. And I think we're right about that. Yeah. We shouldn't give money. Fuck Egypt.
We tend to arm a lot of people that come back and fight us at some point.
And so Rand Paul is always in subcommittee hearings and everything else like that, just trying to inject a voice vote over this. And so they just are aggressively rolling their eyes. I was watching the C-SPAN stuff. So it was in the middle of John McCain leading the National Defense Authorization. I think that's what it was, or the defense bill. And watching him kind of grit his teeth as he sort of allowed for Rand Paul to kind of have his little amendment thing, it was hilarious. It's very obvious that Rand Paul is just pissing people off. So to get to your original question, it's a healthy sign that there was a vote. And it's a healthy sign that there were 36 people voting to sunset these things. It was to sunset them within 6 months. That's better than three. That's better than five. And so maybe it points towards a future in which this can happen more often. But we still are in a basic status quo where Republicans are hypocrites about the use of executive power, the separation of powers, depending on who holds it. And Congress doesn't really want to get their votes recorded.
Also, all of the, and I want to flag here, by the way, that your use of magical realism is like unprecedented and nonsensical in the way we were using it earlier in the podcast. But we'll just keep going with it. That same type of magical realism is that's how Republicans deal with defense spending, right? So just as Democrats will say, like, infinite money can be thrown infinitely in the direction of healthcare, and like probably there's a multiplier effect in there somewhere or something. And anyway, I'm sure it's fine. Exact same thing happens with Republicans when you talk about spending on anything even remotely related to defense, including, as you say, very unpopular defense and, you know, military aid spending. Like, there's just infinite dollars for that as far as they're concerned, and everyone can have it. And because it's there's just such a clear block, yeah, nobody ever needs to go on the record. Everybody just says, like, oh, yeah, more armor for the troops, or, like, more money for Egypt, and everyone kind of nods and smiles, except for the guys that no one wants to sit with at lunch, which are the only people who we even remotely like on the Hill.
Somebody that's not liked by the Republicans is Chelsea Manning, who recently got booted from Harvard as well. Chelsea Manning and Michelle Jones both were going to be at Harvard. Chelsea Manning is a former Army soldier that leaked sensitive information to WikiLeaks and subsequently spent 7 years in prison until commuted by President Obama, and is vilified by the right as what they believe to be a traitor. and sort of, I think, lauded by the left as a whistleblower and also sort of a transgender hero. And so Manning had a fellowship, I think, for a day or something like that. It was like a limited fellowship. But then they ended up deciding not to do that because it was too controversial. And they also, the same week or same month anyway, had a lady named Michelle Jones, who was going to be admitted to the history department as a PhD student after spending 20 years in prison for literally murdering her child. And they were going to bring her in as a reformed felon. And then there was also a lot of political hubbub about that, and they decided to retract them. So both of these have been axed from Harvard. Catherine Mangue Ward, does anybody have a backbone in university administrators anymore?
Well, they never did particularly. I mean, I suppose you could go way back to some kind of golden age when university presidents were just completely unaccountable.
Teddy
wasps.
Roosevelt, right,
yeah,
writing a ball.
Well, there
shooting.
Was that episode at Oberlin where the faculty of Oberlin College in the 1850s or something fought off slave catchers in Ohio who had come.
That is incredibly badass, wow. And yeah, I do not know that story at all.
J.D. Tuchilli wrote a piece about this book. It's like a kid's book now, but it's where the Oberlin faculty went out with guns.
Okay, so I'm going to say that was the peak of faculty bravery. But I mean, I think my understanding is that the Harvard fellows of whom Chelsea Manning was one, of whom Corey Lewandowski was one, also of whom friends were.
And like, Sean Spicer.
Kristen Soltz Sanderson, I think, is a fellow right there. Mary Catherine Hamm. Like, there's a bunch of people. That's quite an eclectic mix of humans. It doesn't, frankly, signify all that much other than, like, this person is interesting and might have something to say. And I think, like, the notion that having anyone be able to put the word Harvard near their name is like somehow Harvard endorsing their like existence and full body of work and like all future activities is a bizarre way to think about it.
Well, this was Doug Elmendorf, who was the former head. He was the head of Obama's OMB
CBO.
Or CBO, excuse me. So not during the Obama years. He was the one who rescinded the invitation after Mike Pompeo, who's the CIA director, if I'm pronouncing his
Chelsea
name right.
Manning.
Well, he's a defense guy, but
right.
he threw a shit fit. And, there's something to be said, and it's the same thing with Michelle Jones, which I think Mike Riggs at Reason.com wrote a really good piece about that. She committed a horrendous crime. She killed her son. But she's the model for rehabilitation, and you realize that in the end, like, neither the right nor the left gives a shit about rehabilitating people. Like, they want you to be guilty of crimes forever and ever and, like, never to be able to reform yourself. These are the actions of weak-willed university administrators. The only reason we're talking about this is because it's Harvard. And how many times do we have to talk about failures of intellectual nerve or seriousness at Harvard before we stop talking about Harvard? I don't give a shit about Harvard. I mean, it's obviously it's one of the very best universities in the world. It's arguably the best university in America. It's got a gigantic endowment. They don't even have to charge tuition if they don't want to. But fuck it. They're bad at what they do. And, Harvard is actually not a leader in academic change or trends. It's kind of like the New York Times. Trends go there to be certified as trends, but they don't actually begin there. And in that sense, if we're going to look for the weak-willed kind of caving in of universities as serious places for intellectual exchange and the production of knowledge, which I think is their primary purpose. It's not about educating, fucking young people. It's about creating knowledge and producing new knowledge and understanding of things. Harvard is bad, but it's a lagging indicator.
So, like, revoking Chelsea Manning's appointment was like it was the same as writing like a Thursday style.
I'm pretty sure that RuPaul probably got bounced from like a speaking gig at Wright State University a couple of decades ago,
and then it
gets mainstreamed
before
as Chelsea
it was cool.
Manning.
I mean, I do want to say that the letter from the CIA director from Michael Morrill, it was like it was a model of what the kind of intellectual engagement on this question should have been. And I think in some ways what the best...
The CIA director or the Harvard guy?
The CIA director. He wrote this letter.
Oh, okay. Which Pompeo, right?
He's a Harvard alum.
The former Michael Morrill, he's the former deputy director, acting director of the CIA, right? So he wrote a letter that was just this like very serious intellectual engagement with like the question of whether or not Harvard should ratify, you know, should ratify giving away state secrets with this appointment. And it's bracketed with like, this is not about Chelsea Manning being trans. This is not about Harvard being liberal or conservative. It's just about whether this specific point is like a moral one or a thing about which reasonable people can disagree. And I think, you know, the Harvard name and the kind of like brand of trying to be intellectually serious and trying to engage on that level is still there. Like, it's not... Yeah, you know, although, I know you're burn it all the ground.
Yeah, I look at Matt and Andrew, help me out here. Catherine went to Yale, which is a college in New Jersey. So you're invested
in prestigious degrees. Be like, Harvard sucks, Princeton doesn't matter.
I mean, if you're from San Francisco, you still need L.A., right? So...
I don't speak California, so I don't know what that means.
If you're from Boston, you still need New York. You need the totemic hate figure that's ahead of you, and you will ultimately defend
you're calling Yale Avis to Harvard Church.
Can you all come up with an analogy involving cows for me?
You're from Oklahoma City. Yeah. You need Tulsa.
Oh, okay. Now it makes sense. I couldn't follow it all.
The point of Harvard is to like ratify the political class. And on that level, I mean, I find that argument, both Morrell's argument, to be both like appropriate and just kind of like indicative of the whole awfulness of the enterprise. I mean, Harvard is there to say you have made it enough in government, out of government, as someone who's a player, as someone who's in media, as someone's kind of, you're part of this here now. And so they're arguing over the details whether we can have a leaker be part of that argument.
You know, when's the last time Daniel Ellsberg is coming to speak? Oh, no, we can't have that. You know, the leaker of the Pentagon Papers.
Oh.
The thing that's interesting about Manning is that the materials that she leaked, it's not clear. You know, there are these wild charges that that led to X number of deaths of assets, American assets in Central Asia and in Iran or Iraq and all of that kind of stuff. There's actually very little evidence for that. What it did do, and this is where I'm in Camp Manning, I'm in Camp Snowden too. Like, what it did is it revealed a series of massive, massive lies that the intelligence community and the defense industry was keeping from us. And that doesn't mean you want to have a world of leakers and all of that kind of stuff. But ultimately, it was a good thing. We are having a different, better set of conversations for Manning having leaked all of that material. And then the question is there a reason to have her talk with or interact with the academic community at Harvard or the intellectual community at Harvard?
And the answer is totally yes.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I want to be clear here. Like, I am obviously pro Chelsea Manning gets to talk to anybody and everybody in academia, and that would clearly be a good thing. But I think to engage on the level of, like, let's all agree that what we're trying to do here is something serious that has high stakes and that, like, what we put inside our Overton window matters, in a world where, like, apparently we can just, you know, have the president holler about people's tits and everyone's fine with it. Like, I think there's something to be said for that kind of, like, you know, maybe ultimately bedrock is not sound, but like the kind of sense of, I'm so sorry, noblesse oblige about how, like, we should conduct these discussions.
No, I agree with that completely. The other thing that was disturbing, you know, in Harvard, you know, let's put the libertarian disclaimer out there, as a private institution has every right to do whatever the fuck it wants. All of that kind of stuff. There's no First Amendment issues.
One of those like Jim Cramer buttons.
We get a WAV file that we can hit whenever we're discussing private institutions.
To be clear, it's a private institution.
Well, Harvard can make everybody bake gay cakes if they want to.
They can.
Like, you know, as a grounds of admission. You know, like,
you can't graduate until you make a gay wedding cake.
This is the thing about, you know, universities always want to have it both ways, where we are citadels. You know, we're a loophole. We're a retreat from the hurly-burly of everyday life. We're outside of the market system and the political system, and we're dealing with ideas. And it's like, you know, then do that, because you can't keep saying that and then letting really stupid politics from the right or the left kind of foul
and
everything. And there was an article, I think it was in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, I read, where there were unnamed sources, so maybe they're not legit, but saying that, you know, part of what Harvard was worried about is like how this was going to play on places like Fox News and Breitbart. And if that's
Which
true,
amazes me that they would care about that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also like after a certain point, you know, I guess. I don't know.
I want to go back a little bit to Michelle Jones. You brought up Mike Riggs' article about rehabilitating Miss Jones, and that was a main thing for the original faculty that planned to bring her on. Just sort of on a cultural level, and I don't have a firm opinion on this. I'm very in favor of rehabilitation. But if somebody served their time, should we as a society go, okay, you're 100% all right now, you've been in jail, you've come out? Part of me goes, I mean, she's a murderess. There is that. I might let her in the PhD program.
Are you going out with, are you dating a Jewess?
Yeah, I was
going
to say kudos on your vintage gender.
I have dated a Jewess,
you
yes.
may refer to me as the editrix of Reason
editrix,
Magazine
right,
from
right.
now on.
I'll do that, the editrix. But I mean, like, is there, when someone exits prison, should we as a society go, you're 100% okay now? Should there be any type of social stigma that follows you outside?
What is the society you speak of? What is society?
What is that? Are the drugs finally kicking in, Matt?
Kicking it for a while, bro.
No, I mean, I think this is something where we've probably gone a little bit too far in not admitting the possibility of a kind of erased record of blank slate rehabilitation, right? I mean, this is something that Reason writes about all the time with sex offenders. The idea that, you know, you send a text to your slightly younger girlfriend when you're 18 years old and then you're ruined for life. You know, I think it's unrealistic to ask humans to, like, actually, you know, delete data about horrific crimes committed by humans. But at the same time, yeah, if you're talking all this nonsense about how Harvard is an institution dedicated to bringing about all kinds of broader social change, which Harvard is constantly talking such nonsense, then here is a nice, this is like an IJ case style, handy dandy, you know, perfect plaintiff kind of scenario. Like, you can't let Michelle Jones in, you can't let anybody in.
Well, you know, there's also a relatively happy ending here, which is she's going to NYU. And NYU, and why I bring up NYU, it's an interesting institution, which when I went to college between 81 and 85, and when I was looking at colleges, most people, like NYU was kind of, relatively speaking, was a joke institution. It was like a commuter campus that happened to be located in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, in the University of Oklahoma, we made fun of it all the time.
Yeah,
it didn't
yeah.
have
yeah.
a proper campus.
Merciless.
There wasn't
I mean,
a square.
You had to, you know, use single,
what kind
you know,
of horse
single
did they
syllable
have?
Words.
They didn't have a horse.
No, but it was not a particularly prestigious institution. And then they had a couple of people who built it up, and they realized, hey, you know what, we have like a campus and a lot of housing available for faculty in Greenwich Village. And in a period of you know, a decade or less, they built it into a great institution. And I know from my grad background in literary studies, NYU during the 80s and the 90s and even now is so much more interesting than Columbia, because it was scrappy and it could be like more freewheeling. They have great science programs, you know, and that's good. You know, so like Michelle Jones will not suffer by not going to Harvard. NYU gains even more credibility, and it's been building that up. And you look at institutions around the country, I always find it fascinating, and it's partly because my academic pedigree is, you know, it's big state universities that are good but are not as prestigious as a Yale or a Harvard. I love to see schools like NYU, Chapman University in Orange, California is one of these places, George Mason University in Arlington and Fairfax, Virginia. They have empire builders who are like, fuck, you know, we have like real assets here in terms of location or in terms of vision of a particular person. And they start doing interesting things because that's how you become good. And it's, you know, that's all good. And the fact of the matter is that I think, you know, what you see in higher education is similar to what you see in media, where the big guys on the block are still big guys on the block, but there are a lot more interesting smaller players because that opportunity exists and people are sharp enough to kind of take advantage of that.
I was so hopeful. Remember when everyone was so stoked about MOOCs? Do you remember that?
Yeah, massively
when it was like,
online.
Yeah, so this was these online internet
massively open online courses. Yeah.
And it was supposed to be basically that we could have superstar professors whose lectures and curricula would be available to anyone who wanted them.
Like, don't we still kind of have that? Doesn't iTunes have like a whole iUniversity
type?
But it's like, yeah, but but it's like all we need is Mark Russell to teach musical jokes.
There were a couple of big VC-funded startups that were going to, like, you know, democratize and revolutionize the way that top teachers, you know, convey their lessons to people. And, like, I kind of thought that that was a great vision of, like, okay, maybe the Harvard brand helps you, maybe the Stanford brand helps you, but mostly if you can give 10 kick-ass lectures and get 5 million people to sign up for them and actually complete your course, it doesn't matter what institution you're at. Unfortunately, it turns out a lot of people sign up for those courses, and then nobody goes to the second one.
So it's just like it's just like real meat space college.
It's just like real
college.
It
is. It's funny that you know, there's also that technocratic vision of education, and the Brazilian education theorist Paulo Freire talked about the banking model of education, where the professor, the teacher knows everything, and then he's just depositing his knowledge into students like a bank account. And that isn't how education works. You know, and it's frustrating because as hard as it is to, you know, Uber is having problems scaling up.
Let me deposit my knowledge in you. Sounds like
a couple professors said that to me.
Yeah, yeah. But it's, you know, that isn't how it works. And it's very hard to scale up quality education, you know, at any level, but, you know, certainly at the university level. Having said that, though, I know my kids are like, you know, I wake up on Sunday morning and they're watching documentaries, they're watching YouTube videos, and in between, you know, animal torture stuff, you know, they're listening to lectures or, you know, or interesting stuff.
Sounds like they know what time Dad wakes up on Sunday morning.
Quick. They put on Planet Earth.
Yeah.
They won't notice we've been watching the same episode for a year. Yeah, no, my children don't think I know a goddamn thing, but it doesn't matter because they're just like, Mommy, ask your phone. And like that's the best case scenario anyway. Because I'm hoping that's how the birds and the bees talk is going to
happen. Well, we'll save that birds and the bees conversation for next week when you all return to deposit your knowledge in us. Until then, I've been Andrew Heaton for Reason. Thank you for listening. Please like and subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.